This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, both online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now that the inauguration is behind us, what does 2013 hold for us with regard to the things we report on daily? Talking jobs, housing, debt ceiling. What will the 113th Congress do about this? More importantly, what will the president do about this? Someone who has her finger on the pulse of the economy, so to speak, is Bloomberg Government senior economic analyst Dr. Neela Richardson. She'll be here in a little while to give us her take. Now, with the yearly pilgrimage to Detroit now complete, of course, I'm talking about the yearly auto show, one can only imagine the many ways that auto manufacturers are trying to get you to purchase one of their more fuel-efficient vehicles in 2013. Hybrids, of course, are gaining in popularity as motorists are looking to save some money on that irreplaceable fossil fuel known as gasoline. And with the expiration of the payroll tax and gasoline prices where they are today, many Americans are starting to tighten their budgets to make that dollar go even further. But I may have a solution for you. Energy analyst Rob Barnett joins me now to discuss his latest study, Natural Gas, America's Alternative to Gasoline. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining me. So what you've detailed here in this study definitely makes sense. I know I've seen them, the vehicles that have the little powered by natural gas logo on the side. My question is, obviously this is a little bit cheaper and more readily available, or is it? That's question number one. And number two, is it easier to gather this natural gas than it is to refine actual gasoline?
Yeah, so I think you've seen consumers looking around for alternatives. And, you know, you've mentioned hybrids. There's compressed natural gas vehicles, which is really what I'm talking about in my study. There's electric vehicles, plug-in vehicles like the Nissan Leaf or Chevy Volt. And so I think consumers are exploring a lot of options. As for natural gas, the fuel is a lot cheaper. And, you know, there are a number of places you can buy it, but it's still pretty limited. There are, 100,000 plus gas stations in the U.S. Only a handful, about 1,000, have natural gas or compressed natural gas for sale. So, you know, it's still very niche market at this time, but it's kind of early days. We're talking about a new fuel. Whether you're talking about electric vehicles, natural gas vehicles, and any alternative, frankly, I mean, it's a small market to start out with when you compare with this sort of juggernaut of cars that run on oil and gas and the internal combustion engine.
You know, Willie Nelson has a tour bus that's powered by corn oil, I guess it is. He'd go around it.
Biodiesel.
Biodiesel. Go around at any fast food place and basically, hey, can I buy some of your corn oil? Some of that biodiesel to throw in there. And the exhaust kind of smells like French fries, from what I understand.
I mean, there's a lot of ingenuity out there. I think people have constantly been looking for, you know, different sources of energy wherever they can be found. And so, you know, some people look into the ground directly for oil and gas, but certainly biofuels is another piece of the equation. And increasingly in the U.S., you've got a lot of folks, T. Boone Pickens, a great example, but others who are saying natural gas is the way to go. Yeah. And that's what I looked at.
All right. So natural gas may be the way to go. You mentioned the 100,000 or so refueling stations for gasoline in the country, and only 1,000 or so of these natural gas. Talk about the economics of setting up. I'm Mr. Gas Station Owner, and I'm now thinking about carrying natural gas. What kind of outlay am I looking at? Can I have the two in the same place?
Sure, you could have, and frankly, that's how it is. I mean, most of the gas stations that sell some of the alternatives also have gasoline and diesel. So, I mean, there's not a requirement that says a gas station can only sell one kind of fuel. They usually sell many types.
And no smoking over here, but really, no smoking over here.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think you see some gas stations willing to make the investment. I think there's a chicken and egg problem, though. So, you know, if you own a gas station to invest in a new pump. That costs money. And, you know, we're really talking about a pretty substantial amount of money. You're talking several hundred thousand dollars to put in the infrastructure for a natural gas pump, essentially. And if you're the owner of the gas station, you want to make sure that there's a market there for that. On the consumer side, you look out there and you say, well, gosh, the fuel is cheaper compared with gasoline, but am I going to have a place to fill it up? So really, you know, who's going to move first, the consumer or the folks who would be putting in the pumps at the stations?
In your study here, Natural Gas, America's Alternative to Gasoline, there's a cool picture of a car sitting in what I imagine is your home garage, hooked up to your little, here it is, homeowner's time to fill overnight station. $4,000 to $6,000 is what we're talking about, but true to the Volt and the Leaf, you know, being able to refuel at your own home, how priceless is that?
Well, and a lot of the solutions, like you mentioned, we see it with electricity. You can do the same thing with gas that involve, you know, plugging up your car when you get home at night, and you don't ever have to visit the gas station, or you certainly have to do it infrequently. I know my wife would be a huge fan of that. She is adamantly opposed to going to gas stations and filling up the car. I have to do that for some reason. And so, you know, we there are a lot of people that I think would like this. But the problem, though, is, you know, if you let your 16-year-old take the car out for a spin, do they remember to plug it back up when they get home? I certainly hope so. Whether you're talking gas or electricity, that could be an issue.
Good point. So we've kind of gone down this commitment path for these alternative fuels now. We're really starting to ramp up, so to speak. Until today, the hybrid sales have been relatively good. They're getting better up and down. If you were to overlay the compressed natural gas vehicle sales onto that chart, what would it look like?
Really, both hybrids, frankly, and natural gas vehicles. I mean, you know, it looks like a rounding error for the U.S. vehicle market. Right now, we sell, you know, anywhere from 15 million vehicles a year. And up, it varies from year to year. It went down a lot as a result of the Great Recession, but it's rebounding. And this year, probably expect 15, 16 million vehicles to get sold. You know, a few hundred thousand of those might be hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as natural gas vehicles, I mean, it'd be a great year if, you know, you saw, you know, tens of thousands sold. So, I mean, you're just really talking about really small share compared with the overall you know, vehicle mix of new cars coming onto the road. That being said, you got to start somewhere. So,
good point.
You know, hybrids have really come up from a small base. It's still small, but, you know, takes time to change something that's entrenched. And right now, you know, the internal combustion engine is king.
I must admit, I do own an internal, several internal combustion engines sitting in my driveway, and I already know for a fact my next purchase will be one of these either hybrid or natural gas vehicles. You hear nothing but good things about them, and I'd like to take advantage of some of the dollar savings that come along with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough choice for a consumer because typically you do pay a little bit more upfront for some of these vehicles, but then you get a fuel savings. So kind of it all depends a little bit on how you view the future, right?
Yeah.
How much do you discount something that occurs in the future? Is a savings tomorrow as good as a cost you have to put upfront today? And so I think consumers kind of wrestle a little bit with a vehicle decision on this front. But the new EPA stickers should help a little bit, because now when you buy a car, it tells you how much they estimate you're going to spend on fuel over the course of a year if you're buying any particular vehicle. So if it were a natural gas vehicle, mm-hmm. you'd see a much lower number there. If it were an electric vehicle, you'd see a much lower number there too.
So Rob Barnett, energy analyst with Bloomberg Government, looking into your crystal ball, peering into the future, your study, Natural Gas, America's Alternative to Gasoline, what would we see as we peer down the road of natural gas and such?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind about transportation is that it's really a multi-generational problem. And not to say that problem in a bad way, but mm-hmm. it if you're thinking about changing it, you've got to be thinking in the course of decades and certainly even longer. And so in the short run, we wouldn't expect, based on our BGov analysis, for, you know, natural gas vehicles, electric vehicles, things like that, to have too much of an impact on the transportation market in the U.S. But if you think out in terms of, you know, 10 years, 25 years, that's when you can start to imagine some change occurring. And that's kind of a tough thing for, I think, investors and policymakers to get their heads around that, oh, if there's something that maybe is worth doing, you do it, but then, you know, you're not even going to see hardly any benefit right. a year or two from now. So it just really does sort of hit home this point that, you know, while you could imagine less reliance on oil and gasoline in the future because of some of these alternative fuels, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, yeah. It's like diving off a diving board, not knowing what the water's going to feel like when you hit it. Hopefully it's warm. And in this case, I think it will be. His name is Rob Barnett. He's an energy analyst with Bloomberg Government. If you want to learn more about Bloomberg Government, it's simple. www.bgov.com is the place to see what we're all about. Don't hesitate to sign up for a demo. See what all of Washington is talking about. Follow us on Twitter at BGov, and you can follow me at Alan L. Scott if you like. We have Rob on from time to time. He's a nice guy.
Thanks a lot.
The granddaddy of all auto shows, held earlier this year in Detroit, showed off a myriad of vehicles with boasted fuel economy. In fact, Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard says the city's replacing their entire auto fleet with electric and hybrid and compressed natural gas vehicles, but not for the fuel efficiency reason you may think.
I'm a Gulf War veteran. I've researched this issue for a long time, but as a mayor, you have to be practical at the same time. So now the technology is there where I think we can start reducing our dependence on foreign oil. I just think that's very, very important for the nation. The hybrids, the plug-in hybrids that are out there right now, plus the electric vehicles, the compressed natural gas, which works very, very well on buses and big trucks, all of that is available to us. And I'm not sure you want to go over all the statistics, but there's a certain percentage that if we just reduce the amount of oil that we use in the country, we essentially eliminate our dependence on foreign oil. 40% of the oil that is used in this country is used for the light transportation sector, the cars and the light trucks. CNG being used in trucks is going to dramatically help us also, but if we can get that 40% down, then we can essentially reduce our dependence on foreign oil to an extent that will change the strategic leverage that we have in the around the world, frankly.
That's Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard speaking about the city's intent to switch to hybrid or compressed natural gas or maybe all electric vehicles in the coming year for their city fleet. How cool would that be to be a city employee in Indianapolis driving around in your brand new hybrid? Or better yet, maybe they've seen that new Lamborghini, the Urus, I believe it's called, or Urus or Urus. It's a new SUV. If it comes in a hybrid version, I'm moving to Indy to drive that. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Joined now by Senior Economic Analyst Dr. Neela Richardson. Hello, Neela.
Hello, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for hobbling in.
Thank you.
For those of you playing along at home, Neela had a slight accident and her knee is in a little bit of a brace now. But took the service elevator up. We're good to go.
I'm ready to roll.
It's a new year. We just finished inaugurating a president for the second time. 2013 has a lot in store, and I would imagine you would be able to give us a summation or lead us down the path of what we could possibly expect in a few economic areas. So I want to kick it off with a discussion about housing. What can we expect in 2013?
I think we can expect more of the same in housing.
Oh, good.
So what we're seeing now is a nascent recovery. We are seeing prices hold steady and even increase in some areas, mainly along the coast. The Midwest and the South are still struggling to increase their house prices. But on the coast, we're seeing that low levels of supply is actually boosting prices. And so we're seeing some good news in housing. We just found out that there's some data that house prices grew 5.6% in the 12 months ending in November. And there hasn't been a monthly decline in house prices since 2011. So that's more good news on the housing front. But again, it's location, location, location. That is the primary rule of real estate. It's not everywhere, right. But some places are driving growth nationally.
Even with fracking in the U.S. federally owned land, it's location, location, location. You're going to, the Department of Interior is going to gather more money at the Bakken region than they will in various others. Simply because of location. And it's funny you brought that up. I've been following this First Amendment trial going on down in Tampa, Florida. And I'm watching the news in Tampa a lot as a result of this. And they were talking about housing prices and how housing has now rebounded and is on the upswing, I would imagine, along the Gulf Coast, being a coastline, location, location. Median house price, you ready for this? $95,000.
Oh, coming from the D.C. area, that's a lovely price to
Tell
have.
Tell me about it. Could you imagine? $97.50 in Georgetown.
Right. And, you know, that's going to differ significantly across the country. But there's a reason why people want to be optimistic about housing. For every house that's built, there are 3 jobs created. Right. Housing has so many spillovers to the rest of the economy. And it boosts stock markets. It boosts confidence. It puts more money in people's pockets. It gives them a sense of confidence to go out and spend. And so everywhere you look, you're going to see this desire for housing to recover. And that desire may be a little bit stronger than what's happening in actuality.
Let's talk about labor. As we discuss housing, you said it's going to create more jobs. Where are we on the labor front? Will we continue to see these strives towards getting more people off of the unemployment line?
So we have some good news in on the labor market side, and that good news is we're not going backwards. But still, this is a lackluster pace. It won't get us fast enough to where we need to be to have a vibrant, strong economy. In fact, at the current pace of job creation every month, we won't get back to the unemployment levels before the Great Recession until 2025. Alan, how old will you be in 2025?
I don't even want to think about it. I'm not good at math, Neela. I'm being upfront.
So at this pace, we have a very long way to go to get to where we need to be. And so while these numbers weren't surprising to everybody, Right. They're just really holding steady. They're not pushing us forward, and everybody wants to go forward now.
Looking for the next 4 years to President Obama, do you think he'll continue to make, I mean, we kind of discussed it just now, but will jobs continue to be on his forefront, considering a lot of the other options that he has to think about at this point in his career, so to speak?
Well, in his inauguration address, the one thing he didn't mention directly was the economy.
Right.
And that was notable to us that are economists.
He even mentioned greenhouse gases, talked about, you know, but didn't mention anything about the economy at all.
But he has significant issues that he needs to address in this first quarter before he can even think of pulling a bill that would stimulate the economy or build infrastructure or do all the things that he talked about in his first term. And first and foremost is getting a budget. Right. There has not been a budget in this city, Alan, in 4 years.
Right.
And so that's the first deadline that's approaching. We need a budget by March 1st. We're facing government shutdown if that doesn't occur by March 27th, the day after my birthday. And so these things need to get done first. His treasury, Obama's treasury pick in Jack Lew, was a underscoring of the need to have someone who can lead these fiscal debates first over prioritizing the economy in the first quarter. So that's what I expect to see. And from all indications, if you look at surveys of business leaders in the U.S., they're really looking for a resolution of this uncertainty before making their decisions. So that priority is absolutely the right one to get this economy growing and moving forward.
Talking about the debt ceiling and issues that we have finance related here in the U.S., an extension of late, or they're discussing it anyway, potentially by May, sometime early spring is what they're looking at, hopefully getting a resolution in for, if not a patch.
Yes. House Republicans and the House Congress are looking to vote on a bill that would not institute the debt ceiling until May. And what this does is decouples the argument. Instead of arguing about all of these things together in March and making decisions in crisis like we did last month,
Sure. We
can drag it out a bit, which is good and bad, right? We don't want to feel as an economy, as a country, that our policymakers are constantly acting out of crisis. We're doing this now because we're about to go off a cliff.
Sure.
We want them to have sound decision making. And by decoupling the budget talks from the debt ceiling, at least there is an aura or it looks like these decisions are being thought out in the best interest of our country.
As we discuss money, And, you know, the payroll tax expired. I know I felt it on my paycheck. I actually noticed it, and my wife went, "What happened?" "What just happened?" I'm like, "You remember that payroll tax?"
Yeah.
Let's talk about the stock market in general. As people try to take care of this bullish market, okay. Will it remain bullish? Are we looking at moving backwards towards a bear? Or what are we going to do here?
Well, the stock market is in a bull market. It's up 100% over the last 3.5 years. And so in this current state, corporate profits are vital. And by current state, I mean the economy last quarter grew 1.5%. That's very low.
Yeah, it's pretty low.
We really need a 3% growth, even higher, to get robustness back into our markets. And so in a slow growth environment, corporate earnings and corporate profits are even more important.
Sure.
Because you can't rely on the economy to drag all these firms upwards in their revenues. You have to rely on profits. And so we're right in the middle of earnings seasons now. We're looking at fourth quarter earnings. And as these big U.S. firms start reporting earnings, we'll have a better indication of what's ahead in the stock market, at least on the corporate side.
Right.
And hopefully when you couple that with a better than expected economy or better than expected growth, we'll get some sustained growth in both sectors.
Layoffs appear to be the order of the day globally. People are being let go for financial reasons. Do you speculate that companies have seen the fourth quarter earnings and said to themselves, "Wow, we need to patch this come first quarter 2013. Let's not just release this, but also couch it with some good news that we've restructured and we are now going to turn a profit, or closer to that profitability margin that one had become accustomed to."
I think overall, layoffs are simmering down. There still could be some tweaks in individual companies to get to that right number.
Mm-hmm.
But what's absolutely clear is that hiring has not begun, that corporations are delaying this decision until they get more certainty on the fiscal side. We're not seeing the hiring that harkens back to that lackluster December unemployment number.
Mm-hmm.
And so until we get this confidence, there's a survey that came out recently that CEOs are more about as optimistic about this economy as they were at the peak of the Great Recession, which wasn't very optimistic.
No, it wasn't. I'm thinking that's not very good. Wait a minute.
So if our business leaders have concern about what 2013 is going to bring, that's definitely going to translate into corporate jobs.
All right. Only time will tell. Will you come back and give us more as 2013 progresses?
I hope to give you optimistic updates on the economy throughout the year.
Sounds great. Put the cyanide away, everyone. Neela will be back with good news.
This time walking.
This time walking. That's true. Take care of that knee. And we will see you again soon. It's Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The NFL has this uncanny ability to monetize just about anything. Bloomberg's Sportfolio host Rick Haro explores the business of the Super Bowl and how the business monetizes as many aspects related to the game as possible.
They monetize everything. By the way, the NFL and the Super Bowl is a $3 billion, $3 billion business, counting the infrastructure, economic impact. If it's a country, it's the GDP of Switzerland. You know, you have an Ad Age stat, which is interesting, and they're saying that 58% of all those watching the ads and the game talk about the commercials the next day, and 47% talk about the game. And so, you know, the women viewers are 46% of all, and they make 85% of consumer purchases.
That's Sportfolio host Rick Haro with Scarlett Fu and Tom Keen on Bloomberg's Surveillance. Speaking of the Super Bowl, what better way to prepare yourself for Super Bowl Sunday? Flip on CBS and watch the Super Bowl edition of Capital Games this Sunday at 11:30. Rumor has it an NFL Hall of Famer will be joining the program to discuss what? Well, you'll have to tune in to find out. That's Capital Games this Sunday at 11:30, immediately following Face the Nation. You don't want to miss it. Capital Impact will be back next Thursday at 11 a.m. as we have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.